This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Joe Elder of the Department of Sociology and the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia is being interviewed on October 10th, 2005. Joe, to begin the interview, let's start at the beginning, and if you would tell us when you were born and where.
Okay, I was born July 25th, 1930. I was the fourth child of my parents, who actually had six. They were missionaries. My father, during World War I, had gone out with the YMCA to sort of work with coffee and donuts with Russian soldiers, as he told me. Arrived in Russia just as the Russian Revolution occurred. The Soviets came in. He was kind of out of work with the YMCA, so he was transferred to Armenia. And he spent 2 years in Armenia working with refugees. At one point he was in charge of a camp of 1,000-some women and kids, mostly. And with all the problems, they had to get food for them, and there was hostility and some brutality and so on. And when he left, there were two YMCA people, my dad was one of them. They were given all kinds of gratitude by the Armenian community, because I guess they had saved a number of lives. That got my father interested in being a missionary in Iran. He already was heading into the ministry. He'd grown up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and he was the oldest boy in that family, and went to a small college, Washington Jefferson College near Pittsburgh, and then he went to seminary, McCormick Theological Seminary, working alternate years to make money so he could keep going to seminary. Worked for the student volunteer movement, which was a fairly evangelical Christian student group, as a secretary, traveling to campuses trying to convince people to either become missionaries or support missions. Met a young other secretary whose name was Ruth Roche, who was also trying to convince people to be missionaries or support missionaries, and they fell in love and subsequently got married and decided at this point they had to be missionaries because that's the pitch they've been making. And they picked Iran. It was a little hard for me ever to figure out why Iran, except that my dad was aware of Iran, and it was almost entirely Muslim, and I think he liked the challenge of going in where there were lots and lots of potential converts.
And his religion was?
Presbyterian. Right. So they went out in the mid-20s. There were a couple of unsuccessful pregnancies, and then finally they got the hang of it, and they began to produce us every 2 years. Girl, boy, and then the last round was boy and girl, my brother and sister. I was born at home. I was told on the kitchen table because at that time there wasn't any hospital there, but there was a missionary doctor. And my childhood was very protected. Spent the first 4 years in a town called Kermanshah, which is in Kurdish territory. And I still have somewhere a picture of my father and mother dressed as Kurds. My mother could pass as a Kurd. My father, with his red hair and blue eyes, was not going to pass as a Kurd at all. It was pretty rough. There was at least one person, Kurd, that was converted to Christianity, who was killed by his relatives. It was a little tough area. Probably my first memories of the compound, there was a pool in the compound, as many Iranian households have. There's a wall around the compound and a pool, and they use it to water flowers and things. And I must have been about four. And I remember we were eating watermelons, and somehow I slipped and fell into the pool. And had this vivid memory of all the bubbles coming up and myself sinking to the bottom. And then a hand coming down from above and fishing me out of the water, very much upset. So I was saved by a young Armenian Christian. So that's a circle around the circle.
Around.
That's right. We were near Bisatun, which is a cliff on which some of the old Achaemenian kings' sculptures are. So I was aware of the ancient Darius, Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes kind of thing. When I was five, we moved to Hamadan, which appears in the Bible as Ecbatana. It was the old Persian capital where Esther approached the king Ahasuerus on behalf of the Jewish people, so there was a bit of reality at that point. And there were graves out there at this old ruined palace at the west side of Hamadan, where ostensibly the graves of Esther and Mordecai were, so there was this awareness of biblical history. Then when I was seven, the 7 years came up, which missionaries had, 7 years in the field and 1 year back, the sabbatical. So we returned to New Jersey, where the churches were the support of my family. And we were very much the honored arrivals. The church had rented a house and decorated it for us. So Life magazine had a picture of this missionary family coming in. Little taste of America. And then we returned to Iran in 38. During the trip across Europe was fascinating both times, because in Germany we did see the Hitler troops, we did see a big parade in Berlin.
Do you remember that?
Pretty vividly. I'd never seen a big parade before. And the swastikas and the hands going up in the Heil Hitler signal.
Wow.
We crossed Soviet Union and were required to close windows because we weren't supposed to see things out the windows. Anyway, all the sort of stories that kids have when on those trips. In Tehran, we were in the capital, and from then on, my family stayed in the capital. These sort of missionaries would work in the boondocks, first of all, and then as their language got better, their administrative skills got better, they typically moved toward the center. And again, I was in a compound, wonderfully protected, big. The church was there, the school I went to was there, soccer fields, volleyball courts, and being a privileged small American community, convinced that we were superior in all ways to everybody around us. We had a big American flag, which we'd hang out on the 4th of July and other days. Aware that the Muslim world was going on outside the gates, but we had very little to do with them. The school I went to had probably 20 different nationalities in it. These were all kids who wanted to study in English. The largest single minority were Iraqi Jews. Huh. Their parents were working in Iran. There's never been a whole lot of love between Iranis and Iraqis. So instead of sending their kids to the Iranian schools where they'd have to learn Farsi, which they didn't want to learn, or the French schools, which were the elite schools, a number of them had figured that English was the language it was going, so they would get into our schools. So the majority of my classmates were from Iraq or Lebanon or someplace like that. Small classes taught with kind of any teachers they could find, missionary wives and occasionally missionaries themselves. The premise was that when we reached the end of the school, which was sophomore year, designed for missionary kids, we would then go to the States and live with relatives or in boarding school somewhere for a couple of years and then go to college. So I never met an American older than 16 as I was growing up, because when they reached that age, off they went. And these were the days of 5-week and 6-week trips to get there. And then World War II broke out and it was hard to get to the States.
Joe, I have to ask you and look ahead. Have all of your siblings been internationally aware like you?
Ever since childhood, a mark on all of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little ahead of the game, but of the six of us, four became Quakers, which is interesting because we were all raised with very strong Presbyterian homes. We had grace mealtimes, we had morning prayers, we went to Sunday school, we went to church. We were thoroughly in the Presbyterian world. But when the time came, each of us sort of looked our own way, and in four of our cases, we ended up being Quakers. World War II was interesting. Iran was caught in the backstage of the war, but probably part of my cynicism about wars and the feeling that they're much more devastating than most people think was watching what happened backstage in World War II. There was a brief battle when the British Army moved in from North Africa and Iraq, and the Soviet Army came in from the Soviet Union to conquer Iran and dismiss Reza Shah Pahlavi, the old king, who was sympathetic with the Germans. He admired Hitler, he admired strong leaders, he admired Kemal Ataturk, and his model was to be a tough leader. And if he had been allowed to remain, he didn't have an army to loan to the Germans, but had the Germans broken through the Caucasus and gotten to Iran's oil, that could have changed the tilt of the war. So the British moving in and the Soviets moving in were to seal off the Iranian oil from the Germans. And then there was Pearl Harbor, and the U.S. became involved in the war. Pretty soon U.S. troops arrived in Tehran. There were a couple of big bases. And the U.S. used the Iranian railways and roads to ship a lot of military supplies from the Persian Gulf up across the Caucasus into the Soviet Union. And the so-called Persian Gulf Command, in their own smug way, maintained that they really won the war, because the Germans had gotten as far as Stalingrad, And then they just ground to a halt, and Stalingrad went on for a week after it was a horrendous, bloody, pointless kind of killing field. But then the Germans began to retreat, and the Persian Gulf Command thesis was the reason they were was that these supplies were now beginning to come in, and the Soviet troops were getting continually refurbished with trucks and tanks and the other stuff. What a military historian will say, I have no idea. But anyway, that was the sort of war we saw. And we befriended the American GIs. They were around. One of them got permission to teach us folk singing and folk dancing. Some of them set up a Boy Scout troop. When President Roosevelt came for the Tehran conference, we knew that he was coming long before most people did, because one of the GIs was in the Army band. And he came in one day and asked my father, does a band ever play Hail to the Chief if the President isn't here? And my dad's guess was no. Well, do you suppose President Roosevelt is coming to Tehran? Why would he come to Tehran? And then, sure enough, it was obvious stuff was coming, and there was the Tehran conference, and part of it was held within a half mile of where we lived under great security. So he was sort of watching World War II from age 9 to, age 14 or 15. The age group was one above me. But the refugees who came through and the total disruption of life, there were bread riots. There was a typhus epidemic that wiped a lot of people. And this wasn't the real war. This was sort of the fallout of the war. But enormous sort of chaos and disability was people living suspended lives, wondering if their relatives were alive, would they ever get back to Poland or back from wherever they came. So it wasn't a great deal of excitement and so on as the war went on. It was just awareness of a whole lot of people suffering. And then the GIs, they were not happy with where they were. There was very little death there. There was more dysentery and things like that. But anyway, it was watching the painful part of the war as far as civilians. And again, the observation of any war is so much harder on civilians than on military. But just as the war ended, the war in Germany had ended, we were able to arrange to come back to the States by being flown by the Air Transport Command from Tehran to Bombay to connect with the Swedish ship Gripsholm, which was carrying refugees back and forth. They're released prisoners of war and wounded from one side to the other. So we sailed on the Swedish ship Gripsholm from Bombay ultimately to New York City, through the Red Sea, through the Mediterranean, picking up some Greek orphans on the way, arriving in New York City, being met by a fireboat with great sprays of fire to celebrate this ship coming in. We were the only ship on the high seas that sailed with complete illumination. We had banks of floodlights. We were painted white. We had a huge Swedish ship on the side and a Swedish flag on top, so that any submarine could know that we were a Swedish ship and weren't to be hit.
Now, but this was after Germany had surrendered?
Germany had fallen, but Japan was still there.
Ah, okay.
And we were sailing through the Arabian Sea, and who would know? We weren't worried, but I guess the ship had to broadcast every 15 minutes precisely what its location was, so that if anybody's periscope spotted them, they would be aware that this was a neutral ship and nothing was supposed to happen.
I'd forgotten Sweden was neutral
right?
In the war.
Yeah. The day we were still on the Gripsholm, we had to stay overnight. There were all the complications of unloading and refugees and passports and things like that. And my father came back on board the next day and said that a huge bomb had gone off at a place called Hiroshima that had virtually destroyed the city, and this may bring an end to the war. And so the next week we were, in where the reports were coming about what the atomic bomb had done to Hiroshima. And then a few days later, what happened in Nagasaki. So the day World War II ended, we were on a train going from New York to my dad's home in Pennsylvania, where his mother was still alive. And all of a sudden, the bells, the church bells, and the factory whistles and all that kind of stuff. It was really, you knew right then that the war had ended and everybody was making all the noise they possibly could to celebrate. So that was kind of auspicious return back to his hometown, and there were people ringing the church bells in a small town most of the night. And
And you're how old at this point?
I was 15.
15.
I turned 15. So that year, we lived in New Jersey, again, near the churches supported by parents. I went to a public high school. I learned very little. It was not a good high school. My parents then left to go back to Iran, and I expected not to see them for 7 years, because that was the way this thing happened.
Oh.
So I went to boarding school for a year, Mount Hermon School for Boys in Massachusetts, which other missionary boys from Iran had gone to.
Oh.
And I actually roomed with another missionary boy from Iran, whose father had been in seminary with my dad, so there was you know, a little nexus of us. And I learned, it was a hard year. It was in terms of being like in a reform school or something like that. The day was scheduled with bells and inspections and demerits and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
But I had an English teacher who taught me English grammatical rules, which I still use. His name was Louis Smith. And the rumor was, if you got a B or better in Louis Smith's English class, you would skip Yale's freshman year, because Louis Smith was a Yale product, and they respected Louis that much. And while I was in Mount Hermon, it was a poor boy school. It was called Where a Poor Boy Gets a Second Chance. We all had to work 10 hours in a farm or the laundry or the kitchen.
Huh.
I pulled farm duty. And my parents, before they'd gone back, had decided that they would make sure I was secure at college. My two older sisters had gone to Wellesley, where my mother had gone, and where one of my aunts was a house mother, so that was a nice arrangement. My older brother had gone to Washington and Jefferson, where my dad had gone, and he had not been particularly happy, and Washington and Jefferson wasn't a terribly good school either. And then he was going to go on into seminary. He was very much planning to be a missionary himself. And having heard what my sisters wrote and what my brother wrote about being in an all-male or all-female school just struck me as weird. And so the only thing I was clear about was I wanted to go to a co-ed school. And Wellesley was not co-ed, and Ivy League was not co-ed. So my parents worked out a deal with an old seminary friend of my father, who is now the president of a small college in Indiana called Hanover College. And I think it was a Presbyterian college. And I was admitted my junior year from high school. Piece of cake, you know, no problems. So when I went to boarding school, where all my classmates were taking their college boards, and most of them were heading into the Dartmouth, Yale, Harvard, Columbia crowd, I was cool. I wasn't taking any exams. I knew where I was going. And then one of these accidents happened, which affects one's life more than one ever thinks. It was February, and the assistant headmaster of Mount Hermon called me in, the person I didn't know, and was saying, we're checking just to make sure all the seniors have a place to go. Where are you going next year? And I said, I'm going to Hanover College. He said, you mean Dartmouth in Hanover? And I said, no, it's Hanover College in Indiana. And he looked puzzled, and he said, is it certified? And I said, I have no idea. College is college. And it was obvious that he didn't think that was a good idea. I had done very well. I was either a valedictorian or whatever. I mean, I'd done well in the grades, which startled the Mount Hermon crowd, because they thought it was a very tough school, and here comes this person who'd never been there, and he was able to come off with one of the highest averages in the senior class.
Joe, I have to ask, was that your native intellect, or had you been particularly well prepared in school over in Iran?
Probably it was, at least in part, because of the intensive small classes that we had in Iran. Because we had a lot of not very good teachers. We had a lot of amateurs who were just, you know, missionary wives and what have you. But the classes were small, and we did our homework and all the rest. So it was good preparation. We would not go to class if we hadn't done our homework, essentially, and we memorized French and Latin and whatever else we were doing. So it was kind of a rigorous thing. So it wasn't hard to get good grades. You just had to do your homework and keep up with the stuff, which I was able to do. So anyway, the assistant headmaster said, we could probably get you into a somewhat better known place than Hanover College. Have you thought of Yale, Harvard, Dartmouth? And I said, you know, my older brother and my sister just had such a weird life in these things, and I want to go to a co-ed college. So then he mentioned, have you ever thought of Oberlin? And I had actually heard of Oberlin, but I said, you know, we don't have any money. My family can't afford tuition. And he said, well, let's, if you're interested in going to Oberlin, why don't you fill out these forms, and I'll write a letter, and we'll see if we can do something. So I did, and in a month, he called me in and said, you'll be pleased to know that Oberlin has offered you a 4-year full tuition scholarship.
How wonderful.
This guy didn't know me from anybody. And a lot of my life, I think, was directed by him into a tough college with all the sort of liberal tendencies which have been imprinted on me ever since.
Yeah.
And where ultimately I met my wife, and my, it was one of those cataclysmic things which, had he not done, I would probably have gone ahead of her college, a very mediocre college, I'd probably been a fraternity boy.
And what was his name?
I have no idea. I can't remember it now.
It was, isn't that interesting?
He was just assistant headmaster. And he was doing his job to make sure that every senior at Mount Hermon went to a good college. But obviously he wrote a letter. And that made a whole lot of difference. So this unknown person affected my life. So then I went to Oberlin, and it was just the greatest place in the world as far as I was concerned. It was not hard to get good grades, although I did get shaken up by a history professor named Harvey Goldberg. Harvey Goldberg, University of Wisconsin, was there. He hadn't finished his dissertation, so he had a fill-in job in the history department. And
amazing.
He was so exciting. Any student who took Harvey Goldberg's History of Europe described his electrical lectures, his style of filling up the blackboard with terms, and then this frenzied sort of lecturing style where he'd stand like a horse ready to start the race, and the bell would go, and he'd start pacing back and forth, and machine gun out this information. I did not do well on Harvey's first exam, and it was probably the first time I was hit hard by a person I would call a true intellectual. And he could sort of see through the fluff and insist that that wasn't very good. So I decided, this guy is tough, and I'm going to learn how to answer his questions. So that was one of the first times that just the challenge of, this guy is bright and isn't going to accept nonsense, you got to know what you're saying. So he had an influence in his own way, and he was taking a Marxist perspective, so that whatever he did in history, you peel it back, and there was somebody making a buck and concealing it through religious liturgy or what have you. And having a kind of intellectual axis that allowed you to look at complex historical stuff and then peel it back, and there was this ultimate causal relationship that was there, made him just very exciting. And he was accessible to students, and so anyway.
Did you take more than one course?
I just took the 1-year course with him. He was only there 2 years, and then he went on to Ohio State and eventually finished his dissertation, and then came and taught in Wisconsin for the rest of his life. The rest is history. By the time I came here, he was, again, a legend, but he was a legend here as opposed to Oberlin.
Did you and he reconnect?
We reconnected, yeah. And during the Vietnam War, we had a couple of interesting conversations because he was opposed to it and I was opposed to it. But I always felt that Harvey was on the top of a ladder someplace. I was never one who could sort of sit up late at night drinking and talking about the French literary circles or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Our styles were different, but I had every bit of admiration for him. So Harvey was one person that triggered me off. I decided to major in sociology ultimately for probably the worst reasons. There were less requirements to major in sociology than in history or psychology or religion, the other things I was sort of looking at. And I was taking music, I was studying church organ, the idea I might earn some money doing that. I played piano most of my life. I was interested in stuff about health. I was on the soccer team, wrote a letter for playing soccer. Met the woman who ended up being my wife, and so on. So it was a right place at all the liberal causes. I was active in campus things. I was on the student council, and I was on the president of YMCA, this sort of religious thing continued all the way through. And the thing that probably, again, switched my life was something that Oberlin had, which was unique. It was called the Oberlin Chauncey Memorial Association. And the history of that was, in the late 1890s, a band of Oberlinians related to the Oberlin Theological Seminary, which was part of the college, had gone to China as missionaries. Men, women, kids. They arrived in Chauncey Province just when the Boxer Rebellion broke out,
Oh my gosh.
They were captured, held, and eventually all of them were beheaded. So when the war ended and the Chinese were required to pay reparations to the Germans, Dutch, French, Americans, and so on, the Oberlin people who with whom they were affiliated were given compensation for what had happened, and it turned out to be a large garden in Shaanxi province, which was kind of payment for this. And the trustees of the Oberlin, now the Oberlin Shaanxi Memorial Association, decided they would build a school in memory of the martyrs, as they call them, and have something constructive come out of this tragedy which had occurred. So they built a middle school, a boarding school, an ag school, and then sometime after World War I, they had decided, why don't we send some graduates of Oberlin to be part of the young faculty? And so these were called Oberlin reps, Oberlin representatives. And I heard about that, and that sounded like just the next step in terms of college. So I got in line to be on the committee to select people, and then when you were on the committee, you sort of learned what was expected. I resigned from the committee my senior year and applied to become the rep to go to Shaanxi province in China, as did the woman who became my wife, as did a very good friend. And three of us were selected that year from the class of 1951 to go to China, except that Mao Zedong had entered the scene and no Americans were likely to go to China for a long time. So the money was there, we were selected to go someplace. The trustees decided to write to various schools they were aware of, I think in Thailand and Turkey and various places, and South India. And they came across some schools in South India that said, sure, we will accept three untrained English teachers, because I think we have a place where they can fit. It worked out that these were schools loosely affiliated with the American Board of Congregational Missions. So they were under missionary supervision, but we would come in as...
Of any particular religion?
Well, the Congregationalists.
The Congregationalists, yeah, okay.
Right. So we were technically affiliate missionaries of the board, the Congregational Board of Foreign Missions, although we were salaried by Oberlin and our responsibility was to Oberlin. But we came in under the rubric with their health insurance scheme and all the rest.
I see.
So the 2 years teaching in India as an Oberlin in China representative probably was another major influence in which way I went, because I knew almost nothing about India.
Uh-huh.
I'd read a couple of books on the voyage going over. It took us a month to get from...
Oh, you sailed over?
We sailed. This was before the days where airplanes were standard fare. We sailed on the Queen Mary to England and spent a week in England and bought some books, and then sailed for 2 weeks on the Chusan through past Gibraltar and the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, the Red Sea.
Oh my God.
Arriving in India on October 2nd, 1951, which was Mahatma Gandhi's birthday, and people in India were still sort of reveling in the fact that the person who'd been the thorn in the side of the British was now, who'd been assassinated by them, but this was now a national holiday. Anyway, there we were in India, and I discovered that almost everything I'd read about India, which included Nehru's discovery of India and a couple of journalists, thing, dealt without telling me just with North India. And I would see things that made no sense. It contradicted what I had read. For example, in Discovery of India, Nehru describes the caste system and says that although you marry within your caste, you must be sure that when a marriage occurs, the bride and groom are not related 7 generations on the father's side or 5 on the mother's side. And this avoids the sort of recessive genetic problems that might occur. Well, about the first wedding I went to in South India, they said something like, you'll be interested to know that the bride's mother is the sister of the groom's father, or something almost as absurd as that. And I said, but you can't do this. And it took a long time for me to realize that the Dravidian kinship structure in the South is very, very different from the North.
Mm-hmm.
And that the sense of what is Hinduism and what has been adopted and adapted and so on has been a fascinating historical process. 2 completely different language groups. The Tamil language is one family, and the Hindi and the Indo-European language and Sanskrit are another. anyway, that sort of got me off on what I spent the rest of my career trying to sort out, how this whole thing worked. So we were in there in South India watching this amazing complex civilization. In the center of the city where we were, which is the city of Madurai in the south, the center of Dravidian civilization, there was a huge 14-acre temple that had all the sort of vigor of the temple in Jerusalem at a height, I imagine. Crowds of people, lots of priests, a daily cycle of ritual, a whole other world in itself.
Were you and your wife pretty comfortable in this setting? Did you feel alienated?
We were much too privileged. We'd arrived, and the Christian community there treated us as though we were young missionaries, and this was the one way that was the Lord. We lived in the missionary compound. We lived in a house that was...
This is side two of tape one of the October 10th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder. You're in Madurai.
In Madurai, that's right. Our workload was incredibly light. In fact, since this whole thing had been constructed by correspondence that took 3 weeks ago, one way or another, when we arrived, all set to step into a classroom, we met the committee that had been in correspondence with the congregational board, and they said, well, what did you plan to do when you come here? We said, well, we thought you might have some ideas. They said, well, why don't you rest for about a week, and we'll come back and talk about it. So it was clear they didn't have any clear idea what to do with us. So there were three high schools, and each of us ended up teaching English in the sort of junior and senior class of the high school. But we didn't know how to teach English. The classes were huge. We were supposed to teach conversational English because we could converse, but our accent was different, so that was not particularly easy to work with. And there was no syllabus to follow. And in an hour with, say, 45 boys in the same room, you're not going to do a whole lot of conversation. So I don't think people learned very much English from what we were there. But there were other things that we did. There was a college that hadn't, a women's college that hadn't graduated its first class of women. And they were very eager to get us involved in training a choir and doing dramatics. So we ended up coaching a couple of plays. We did Antigone, we did She Stoops to Conquer.
Really?
With all women casts. There was a choir, and if you worked hard, you get the altos and sopranos to sing separate notes, so it sort of came out. So we did what we could. It was like sort of proto Peace Corps. But in the process, we were becoming more and more. We learned a little bit of Tamil. We hired a teacher so that we could speak a little bit. And each of us gathered material for our master's thesis. My master's thesis was on caste in the Protestant Christian community in Madurai. Starting with a thesis which showed how little I knew about the caste system. The caste rested on the concept of reincarnation. The idea being that you were born into the caste you were because of your previous life. Therefore, if you didn't believe in reincarnation, the caste system should end. I mean, that would seem to be logical. Well, it was obvious that not only did the caste system not end, it was every bit as strong among Christians as it was among Hindus. I gathered data on about 2,000 marriages in these various, like, five different Protestant congregations, and less than 30 of the marriages were intercaste. And all the rest were just exactly as Hindus would have done them, which indicated that it's not, the idea of reincarnation plays a very insignificant part in how the caste operates. It's much more in terms of the marriage rules and which nephew can marry which cousin and so on. And so when you go out to arrange the marriages, you step into a kinship network that's prepared to pick and choose among the group and line them up. And it's something you begin doing when kids are fairly small. So by the time they're reaching marriage age, you and your relatives have rather singled out which two young people are going to get together.
Uh-huh.
Well, that... Now it seems pretty trivial, but it was stunning to me to discover that casteism didn't rest on Hinduism. It was quite able to function separately. And my wife did her study on high school girls' attitudes toward marriage, because every marriage virtually was arranged. And to what extent were these 15, 16-year-old girls looking forward to it? To what extent were they afraid of it? To what extent did they think they might try a career outside marriage? So she did a sort of a questionnaire type thing, which they filled out. And then subsequently, back in the States, she gathered some data from a high school in Dayton, Ohio, the same questions in English, and then compared with the American high school student girls said compared to the Tamil high school girls, which was itself an interesting study. So we came back to Oberlin. Part of our pay was to spend a year back in Oberlin with the Oberlin in China Memorial Association, paying our tuition. And so it was essentially a free master's degree to be there.
I see.
And part of our job was to go to the dormitories and meet with students and talk up the program and get students interested in applying or whatever. So that was fun. We had slides. Our first daughter was born while we were in India. And so that was a big thrill to bring a little toddler into a dormitory. People would get all cuddly with her.
Now, you and your wife were married when?
We were married shortly. We graduated in June of 51. We got married in August of 51.
And then
we sailed for India in September, got there in October, and then China was born in April.
Uh-huh.
So, and this, I can say now, was not part of our plan. In fact, when we were the first married couple to be hired by the Oberlin Chance Memorial Association, and I remember talking with Florence Fitch, who was the woman in charge of the Board of Trustees, and she was asking us, what about children? And we said, no, we are modern, we have no money, we're not going to have children until we're pretty well established. So we reassured her on false pretenses that this would be no problem. And we were as surprised as anybody when we discovered that all we learned in the class on marriage and family was irrelevant to what actually happened. And it was kind of funny because we kept it a secret as long as we dared. And then when it was about February or March, we finally decided we'd write to the Board of Trustees and say this was happening and it wasn't part of what we planned. But we didn't think it was going to interfere with my wife's ability to teach or mine, because the cook had a wife and she could be the babysitter, so it would all work out. Well, we got a letter back from Florence Fitch, which she could have written if we'd have told one of us had died, because it was God acts in mysterious ways beyond the knowledge of humans. And if this is what God has chosen to do, we will accept it, sort of thing.
I see.
That's good. Because there wasn't a whole lot we could do about
not too much you could do.
So Shadi was born in the summer break. If we'd have been planning it, we couldn't have planned it better, because the school ended early March, I think. And then we went up to what was called the Hill Station, which is where it's cool. And Shadi was born the 12th of April. With the private physician and little four-bed maternity hospital, so we had great care. And then by the time a month had passed, by the time we got back down to the plains and Joe started teaching, she was on her feet and the cook's wife was able to be the babysitter. We learned later that some of the girls in my wife's class had not recognized she was pregnant because she was tying the sari and it just looked like she had a cumbersome way of tying it. And then she appears 2 months later with a baby, and they're wondering if there's some other way of creating children than the old way.
The old-fashioned way.
It did involve, the lower abdomen and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, having a baby was just great. People loved having the baby, and it was a great sort of device to have people be very friendly about it. And the second year we were there, we were finally able to move off the missionary compound. A missionary family came that was entitled to this huge, huge house. And so we were able to live in a regular Indian neighborhood with Indian neighbors on either side and so on. So the second year we were there, we felt much more like we weren't the great white foreigners in this huge compound, but we were where we could look out the window and watch people harvesting rice and watch the funeral processions go past the house, and much more part of what life was like. So we're back in Oberlin, get the master's thesis, and that year I had to decide what my career was going to be. I still sort of had the idea of going into Chinese studies because several faculty members I admired had done Chinese. And there wasn't any field of Indian studies to speak of at that time. The Asian studies had been either Near Eastern studies or Far Eastern studies. And India had been left kind of in the lurch for the London School of Economics or British School of Oriental and African Studies, the colonial enterprise. And so people wanted to study India typically went to London. And there wasn't much of a center here. But while I was debating, again, fortune stepped in. The Ford Foundation had concluded that America desperately needed scholars who were conversant in non-Western parts of the world. So they created something called the Foreign Area Training Fellowship Program, the purpose of which was to find people on PhD tracks in humanities, social studies, whatever, and if they were willing to take time out to learn language and see a focus outside Europe and the United States, that you might get funded through grad school. So this was absolutely providential. The timing was perfect. I applied for it and decided, okay, I'm going to go in Indian studies, whatever that may be, and was interviewed. And it was a 1 year at a time thing, but got the first year, which meant that I could go wherever I wanted for graduate work. I applied to four places, two of which had the beginning of Indian studies and two of which just were sort of good sociology places. And I was getting some funding. Princeton was going to give some money, and Cornell, I think, had a little bit of money. But I had been accepted to Harvard. And as far as I could tell from the sociology faculty in Oberlin, with whom I was becoming increasingly impressed. I mean, Harvey Goldberg was the first professor to sort of say, wow, this is exciting. But there was a Milton Yinger, who was in sociology. There was a George Simpson, who was in anthropology. They'd written a lot of stuff on race relations, and they were very concerned about the U.S. race relations. And then there was a guy named Maurice Stein, who taught urban sociology, and he had the same almost approach that Harvey Goldberg did, just, you know, very tough and very demanding. So I talked with them, and they all said, well, if you can pay for Harvard, by all means, go to Harvard. Because at that time, the leading sociological theorist named Talcott Parsons was in Harvard. Huh. And people either hated him or felt he was, you know, the new Newton. He was going to break through this thing. So I went to Harvard.
And Ford paid the whole
Ford
freight.
Paid ultimately for that year, the second year through prelims, 2 years in a village in India writing my gathering dissertation, and 1 year back in Cambridge writing my dissertation. So I only had to be a TA for one semester out of that whole period, which was just great.
That's really impressive, Joe.
It was very lucky. Really nice. And it was always, you weren't sure it was going to continue the next year. The scariest year, I guess, was when I'd been in Harvard for maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks and had to apply for the next year, and nobody knew me in Harvard. If I get dropped, I'm just no place at all. I'll be an elevator operator or something like that. And the interview didn't seem to go particularly well because one of the people who interviewed me was from Cornell. And he was saying, if you're serious about being an Indian specialist, you should be in Cornell because that's the only place that teaches Hindi and other sorts of things. And I had to avoid explaining to him that one reason I didn't go to Cornell was that I had a friend of mine who was there training in sociology, and he'd written to me and said, Joe, do not come to Cornell.
Oh.
There is a split in the department which is destroying students, and it's a very unhappy place, and there's no way you could come and not get embroiled in it. So I'm able to make it through, but don't come. So to tell this person from Cornell that I wasn't going to his place because I'd been told that it was a terrible place, it was delicate. But anyway, it worked out. So I spent a whole lot of my time the first year doing the statistics, which everybody has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not particularly good at it, but I was able to pass it. A little bit of Indian was there. There was a Sanskritist named Daniel Ingalls, who is one of the world's distinguished Sanskritists, but I wasn't into Sanskrit. He taught a couple of undergraduate courses, which I sat in on. One was called The Civilization of India, and the other called was History of British India. And my sense was that in his mind's eye, he had been reincarnated as a British colonial officer before because he just loved the story of the British Raj and all the things that happened. So he was my India contact. And the one funny event, which is worth recounting, at the end of my first year taking his classes, it occurred to me that it wouldn't be bad if I'm going to specialize in India to learn enough Sanskrit to recognize why it's the language it is and the sacred text would seem to play such an important part. So I had arranged to take, I think, a directed study course with Dan Ingalls, meeting once a week in his cell in the library. And I sort of asked him, thought this was a bright idea, what would you think if I were to take 1 year of Sanskrit, just to become familiar with the basic term. Well, I couldn't have said anything more offensive as far as he was concerned.
Really?
The temperature dropped about 20 degrees. He was already tall, and he sort of went really stiff. And he looked way down at me, and he said, 10 years or nothing, he said. The point is that if you're going to learn Sanskrit well enough to do anything with it, it's going to take 10 years. And if you're not, you're going to depend upon other people's translations, and don't waste my time taking Sanskrit. It's very good advice, because... It would have taken most of my next year, I think, to learn Sanskrit. So it's a killer language in terms of the amount of time you take. But anyway, there wasn't a whole lot of India stuff there. But there was a lot of Tapa Parsons, and he was the central theoretical figure. He had coined his own set of terms. He was developing the concept of sort of the nuclear cell of social behavior. And I think he really felt that he was on the brink of coming up with the atomic structure of social behavior, so that you could begin to have accumulated laws and regularities just as physics. And there were sort of constant comparisons with the intellectual breakthrough, where you, when the right concept comes, like mass or density, then, you know, bing, it's there, and you can begin to move. So it was a really exciting place to be. Furthermore, I was delighted to be there because four different types of behavioral sciences that decided they would work together with the notion that since human action really has various complex dimensions, that all of us should know something about each other. So to get a degree in PhD in the Department of Social Relations, you had to pass a test in clinical psychology, social anthropology, and sociology. So we were in with people who were going to be psychoanalysts, we're in with people who were going to be, you know, on the Trobriand Islands someplace,
yes.
We're in with people who are going to do, you know, personality testing, and then sociologists. So it was just a feast, all the time.
And that must have been groundbreaking. That probably wasn't happening at any other place.
It was very, very rare, and it was the kind of thing that Harvard could pull off. And so long as they had bright faculty fully committed to this, which they did, they were sort of intellectual giants in each of these fields. I remember sitting at a seminar with where the faculty would be doing a lot of the discussing, the grad students would sit like little mice on the edge, and then we get an A at the end of the semester for having sat in, or maybe do a paper or something. But it was just very, very exciting.
Joe, do you have many colleagues to this day from your time at Harvard?
Not very many. We were a very small cohort. There were nine of us who came in uh-huh. sociology, and about half dropped out. And then the one I was closest to died quite young, and then the other one sort of went off into the commercial world. So the particular set, I know often you end up with a very close team in grad school, but mine was small, and then got smaller, and then kind of disintegrated. The one person who was in the same group with me, Neil Smelzer, already was, in a sense, 2 or 3 years ahead, because he was a Harvard undergraduate. He was a Harvard junior fellow, which meant that he'd been singled out to be truly important. And Neil went on to become, to have a very, very distinguished career as a sociologist. So he was really more junior faculty when I was there. And then all the others sort of, as I say, with this odd set of disintegration. So I was surprised because I thought these would be my friends forever. My father's classmates in seminary, he just, you know, they were always, we had missionary prayers every day.
Uh-huh.
And when we get to, you know, Pete Smith or something, he says, I was in seminary with him. So I was, there's this sense of this is the bonded group that you'll have. Now, ironically, the intellectual friends that I've developed have been largely a multidisciplinary group of people who work with India, the way my intellectual career has moved.
Interesting.
But I was thoroughly embedded. I learned to speak Parsonese, as we called it.
Oh, you did?
Right. And it was a new language. And if you were there long enough, you could become the interpreter of the word. Because after Talcott Parsons would talk, three-quarters of people wouldn't know what he said. And then they'd come up and say, Joe, what was he talking about? You say, well, there are these four different aspects of human behavior, the AGIL, the sort of nuclear structure we go through. And for probably 2 or 3 years after I came here, I would begin every sociology course with saying, let me describe the nuclear structure of social action. And I'd take his model, which had four cells to it, lay it out. And it was about the third or fourth year I was here, at the end of a semester, somebody said, Joe, the first day, first week, you laid this model out of the way in which social interaction occurs, the nuclear structure, and you never referred to it again. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's true. It's not very useful. And it proved ultimately, you know, not to be very useful. But the intellectual challenge of trying to work this thing out, and was there any evidence that there were, as with atomic structure, there were parallel sorts of exchanges.
Uh-huh.
It was great intellectual fun. And I look back on it as very stimulating, even though ultimately it proved fruitless because human behavior doesn't work like physical behavior. It's constantly changing and being recreated and so on. You just don't have the regularities that you have in the physical world.
But my sense is that it really forced you at the time to push your intellectual process further.
Right, and to look for the regularities.
Uh-huh.
And if you look, you know, you're likely to find something, and to define what it is that is being given by this to this. I remember one seminar where Tucker Parsons was working on exchanges. The big thesis was that you had boundary exchanges. And in economics, you have supply and demand, and in the electoral process, you have contingent approval and electoral support, something like that. And we were in one of these exchanges, and he finally said, I'm looking for a word that means precisely this. I want each of you who speaks a language other than English to give me the word in your language that might fit what I'm after. And I thought that was pretty cute. And we had people from Korea and people from Burma and so on, so trying to come up with these words that describe this particular thing that A gave to B and B gave back to A, so there was some kind of stuff like that. So it was fun, it was intellectually challenging. The Harvard campus is very hard to beat in terms of people coming. We were not part of the campus life, but by the time you have two kids, which we now had, you're in impoverished housing and you're meeting the mothers of other people who are impoverished. So we did meet some grad students who were, had kids about the same age that we did. 2 years there, passed the prelims, and then the money was enough to go to India and live in a village for 2 years, which was, my dissertation was the impact of a large sugar factory on this small village. I wanted to see what happened when a whole different social formation came to a place where you had inherited patterns of exchange and services and so on. And I didn't want urbanism to get in there, because urbanism would be very messy, who lives where and so on. So this was ideal. The sugar factory draws on sugar cane and doesn't need to be in a city, it just can be some place where it can draw the cane. So this factory decided to be built at the intersection of a railroad where there was nothing more than kind of a train station here and a small village from which they bought the land. So I arranged to live in the mango grove of the village.
Wow.
And talk to people about how life had changed since this factory had come that employed about 1,200 people.
Was this in southern or northern?
Northern.
Yeah. Northern.
Yeah. And by now I'd studied Hindi and was able to sort of work my way around in that part of the world. I was a sociologist to the extent that I had questionnaires, or interview schedules, so I had samples that I drew. I was an anthropologist to the extent that I sat in a tent and took notes every night about what happened.
Was your family with you?
Oh yeah.
In the tent? Thomas
Smithy and two kids, right? We were elder family Robinson living out there in the world. People wanted to visit us, so we put up a guest tent. We were convinced the village was going to have its book on American family structure finished before I had my book finished. The impact
of the
factory on the village. It was interesting because when you're there and people are asking you questions, you're forced to think of the world a little bit differently. They were puzzled about how we got married. Well, you know, our parents had not arranged the marriage, and that made them suspicious immediately. This was somehow a shady arrangement. We had said to them that we decided to get married, the parents had approved it, and they'd even helped pay for it. So, and then the kids were legitimate. We seemed to be sort of taking care of them. Well, they were puzzled that we weren't having kids as often as they were. And then, but were we of the same caste? And we said, we don't have caste in the United States. And that didn't make any sense. Well, how did you know each other? Well, we were in the same college. Is college a caste? No, college isn't a caste. And then it began to occur to us, probably in a way, college is like a caste, because Who comes to visit us? Old college friends. Joe and Joe are living out in a tent in India, and we're around the world, so why don't we drive our little Renault out to the village and stay with them for a week and see what it's like. So we had this kind of string of classmates and other visitors come, almost all of whom were from Oberlin College. And the village began to figure out, whatever they say, Oberlin is a caste. They marry each other, they eat with each other, they loan each other money, they stay in each other's guest houses.
Joe, that's really interesting.
Right, yeah. And had we stayed there till our kids grew up a marriageable age, we wouldn't have had a problem because we couldn't marry any of the castes that were there. So if we were to stay living in India, we would have had to find something that was sort of the equivalent of a non-category. Probably be liberal arts graduates generally from English colleges or something like that.
Yes.
But it didn't fit any other way. And it was very interesting because we were relating to the caste system. We were uneasy with the caste system. The person that we became closest to in the village was what we called an untouchable. He was about 12 when we got there, just a kid, and he offered to sweep around our tents. And then he was bright and he could ride the bicycle, so then he would do errands for us, he'd go to the post office and get stuff. And then he would babysit for us when we were away. We sometimes both want to be off to a tea party or something. But he was a bungi, which was the lowest group. And at one point we decided, well, we'll give him, along with this small pay he was getting, we'll feed him, because then that takes the burden off the family. Wow. As soon as people knew we were feeding him, the electricity went off. And my wife was visited by a group of women from the village saying, you can't do this. You can't eat off of plates that he eats off of because they're contaminated. And so we had to set up untouchable plates. And his were definitely different. Ours were stainless steel and his was plastic. And he had a plastic cup. And then he wouldn't sit at the table. He'd sit sort of around the corner a bit.
And you had to do this in order to continue with your
right,
work.
This was one of those concessions that you make where you feel this is crummy. And between us and Bola, it was a joke.
Right.
Well, here they come, so okay, you will take your plate and sit over there and so on. But he also recognized that if he pushed it, then he would be in serious trouble, or his relatives would be in serious trouble, because he was being watched to see if he was being uppity and pushing his luck. So to that extent, we just had to accommodate ourselves to the fact that that was the way things happened. Before we left, he got married, partly because I think he was aware that his monthly income was going to end after we left, and so he was as well positioned as possible. And we faced something of a dilemma because he invited us to his feast. Okay, now, people said, if you eat his food, you're as low as he is. And yet, I was not going to not eat his food because he was a bungi. So we solved the problem this way. The wedding feast occurred about 2 or 3 in the morning. So Joe and the kids stayed home. Joe's my wife's name. I went to the feast, and it was clear that I was being observed very carefully because I could hear people sitting on the rooftops coughing in the dark. This was the biggest show going on. There was drums and music and stuff. And then at the appropriate moment, out came the meal. And it was lentils and then this pig that they'd cut up. And it was cut in chunks about that big, and there was fat on it, and the hairs weren't all up. It was pretty grisly stuff. But I was going to eat it because, well, it was a friend. And I knew that we were close to the end of the stay, and I thought, well, I have most of the information I want, so if there's really a negative reaction, I haven't lost very much. The problem for me was to get it down my throat with this blubber and hair and all the rest of it. Well, the next morning, one of the closest high caste neighbors came around and said, are you going shopping today? The shopping town was about a 20-minute bike ride away. So I said, yeah. He said, well, mind if I go with you? I said, well, sure. So I knew that the message was going to be given to me as we drove the bicycles. So we're riding along and talking about one another. And then he sort of says, Bola got married last night. Said, yeah. And people said he had some food. Yeah. Well, people said, you actually ate some of it. And I said, yeah. And I waited for the thunder to roll. He said, we talked about that a lot this morning. And we finally figured that since you really aren't from here, it doesn't matter. And that was it. So they forgave me for doing something which, if he had done it, he would be in serious, serious trouble. He would have disgraced his family, and there'd be all kinds of pollution clearing activities he had to carry out and so on. So I was very grateful the village had was at that level of tolerance. But it was a reflection of the business. How do you live with people who are insisting on inequality when you feel at your gut level that it's not something that you want to go on through?
Joe, were your children playing with local children?
Yeah,
then?
Pretty much so.
And that worked well?
Didn't seem to be a problem. Right? And they each were picking up enough Hindi to play with kids. Our son was just learning English at the same time. And what he did to solve the language problem was he used both the English and the Hindi word side by side. So he said, there's an oont camel, or there's a hathi elephant, or something like that. So, just a way of blending these two languages together.
Was your daughter old enough for school yet?
We homeschooled.
Oh.
Yeah. My wife had brought along the Calvert school system, which, ironically, I'd been trained with for the first, when I was in Hamadan. I was homeschooled by my mother and
an
Armenian lady until we got to Tehran, where there was a regular school. So I was homeschooled with my older sister, who we just sort of were in the same class together with two little English kids who came over. Their dad worked in the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And so we had a small foursome of homeschoolers. And when we were in Hamadan, this was the time that the English crown was going to, I guess it was Edward, and then he didn't want the crown, he wanted to marry